Senate Agriculture and Veteran Budget Division will come to order.
Good idea.
We will start right out with State Veterinary, State Veterans Cemetery Study Report, and Mike Poliski, Deputy Commissioner's here, and so is David Swanstech, I think it's spelled. So if you'd both come up there, and we'll start and do your thing, and then we'll take questions from the members if they'd like to ask them. And okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. With me this afternoon is David Swanstech, our Cemetery Director, who's going to provide you an update on the cemetery.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. Thanks for having me here today. I'm prepared to present to you a presentation I was asked to put together, essentially a demographic study. That's looking at possible locations for future state veteran cemeteries in the southern part of Minnesota. As you know, we have Fort Snelling here in the Twin Cities, which is a national cemetery, as well as our state facility in Little Falls as the only state veteran cemetery in Minnesota. The report that you have in front of you has a narrative and some exhibits in the back. I'll kind of bring the exhibits up on the screen here and provide you with a little information to make sense of what these are attempting to show you. There's two. The National Cemetery Administration provides grants to states to develop or construct state veteran cemeteries. We were the recipient of a grant for the Little Falls Project, and we have submitted a pre-application for a grant for a proposed site in the Duluth area. Demographics that NCA, National Cemetery Administration, uses, they look at 75-mile radiuses around either existing or proposed sites to determine the veteran population that would be served by such a facility. Exhibit 1 shows the service areas of Fort Snelling, Little Falls. The red ring represents a 75-mile radius around Little Falls and Fort Snelling. And then the respective pink counties represent the counties that are considered to be served by these two existing facilities. If the 75-mile radius ring touches a county, the county is considered to be served. And then also showing counties in the Duluth area that would be served by the potential site in that area. What's left on the graphic in white are the counties remaining in Minnesota that would be considered by the National Cemetery Administration to be underserved. My report, I looked at the populations of white counties in the southern half of the state. It's my understanding that that's what was requested of me. So I used demographics that are provided by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. They've estimated veteran populations all the way out to the year 2030, county by county in all 50 states. In this study, we had used population estimates for the year end of 2010 for the Duluth project. So in the interest of consistency, I used the population figures for the southern counties the same date, September 2010. What I did then was looked at how a 75-mile ring would fit into the whole over the counties in white. Subsequently, broke that down a little bit further to southwest, southeast areas. I tried to find the highest or the most area of most condensed veteran population. Came up with the conclusion that there's two areas that would be targets or kind of the sweet spot, if you will. Southwest Minnesota. That ends up being in the Redwood Falls area. That incorporates the counties on Exhibit 2 that are shown in orange. And those counties represent a veteran population in orange, roughly 18,000 veterans. I didn't include any counties that are touched by the red rings of either Fort Snelling or the Little Falls Cemetery. And taking into consideration identifying a target area, I drew an additional circle that's shown in green. And that's a 50-mile radius circle. And what we've historically in Little Falls, it's my understanding that Fort Snelling's experienced the same thing, is that the majority of your burials, about 80% of the burials that you do at a facility, tend to come within a 50-mile radius of the site. Once you get outside the 50 to 75-mile radius, the percentage of veterans that choose that facility tend to fall off quite rapidly. People tend to choose a more local option than for burial. So in studying the south west, or excuse me, the southwest part of the state, the green ring, I moved that over counties that tried to incorporate all the county seats of those counties. And that put that target area right over Redwood Falls. It's not saying that that would be the spot, but it identifies an area that would serve the largest population in that area. In comparison, the project it's been proposed in Duluth, the service area of that site serves about just over 20,000 veterans. So they're fairly close in population. You may wonder how we arrived at Duluth. Triennial review that we undertake, or that the National Cemetery Administration does, of the cemetery every 3 years. We had a discussion with officials from the Grants Office in Washington, D.C. About any demographics that they had that would indicate a possible area for a future cemetery in Minnesota. They identified the Duluth area mainly because of the veteran population in St. Louis County. Outside of the metro area, St. Louis County has the largest veteran population in the state. And so taking a radius around some of the underserved counties in northeast Minnesota, it was determined that approximately 20,000 veterans live in that area. So it provided the greatest number of veterans in an underserved area in Minnesota. Thus, as identified by the National Cemetery Administration, Duluth became the focus of a possible second state veteran cemetery. As you'll see, moving to the southeast part of the state, I've identified counties in green that are considered to be underserved. The six counties identified in green, there's a veteran population estimated in September 2010 to be just over 14,000 veterans. So as you can see, there's fairly significant veteran populations in both the southwest and the southeast part of the state that are considered to be underserved, further identifying the 50-mile radius of each of these sites. Exhibits 4 and 5 show a more realistic, actual number of veterans that would most likely use the facilities within 50 miles of those areas. See on Exhibit 4, the green 50-mile radius encompasses 23,000 veterans. That would be the target area of Redwood Falls. And then in the southeast part of Minnesota, the target area there ended up being Stewartville. And the 50-mile radius, not encroaching on Fort Snelling, estimated that there's 29,000 veterans, 50-mile service area in the east part of Minnesota. We got back a priority list from the National Cemetery Administration in October, which showed the Duluth project ranking 16 out of a total of 55 projects that had submitted pre-application for construction funding through the National Cemetery Administration. The projects that were for the establishment of new cemeteries, Duluth being an estimated served population of 20,000, the next closest state with the population was around 10,000. So as you can see, using the numbers from Exhibits 2 and 3, the populations that we would use for Minnesota veterans that would be served in the National Cemetery Administration 75-mile radius, both sites in the southwest and the southeast would appear to compete with all other projects that were ranked below the Duluth project. So in other words, if these projects were submitted on a pre-application basis, currently they'd probably end up 17 and 18 respectively on the list of priorities for funding for grants.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's worth mentioning that the way they fall in the order of the list is based on how many veterans they're going to serve. So that's why we're looking at the Duluth area. There's a large number of veterans up there. It puts us higher on the priority list for the feds to fund this. And these cemeteries are totally funded by the federal government. The state would be on the hook for any tails. So, you know, the maintenance and the staffing of that. And I'd also like to mention, too, that Mr. Swantek mentioned we went through a survey by the federal government of our state veterans cemetery not long ago. And the report came back that we were one of, if not the best, state veterans cemetery in the nation. So we're very proud of that. So if we're looking to expand cemeteries, what we need to look at is where are we going to maximize, where are we going to be able to serve the most number of veterans? And then that's what the VA, the federal VA, wants us to look at when we're placing future cemeteries.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, you know, I really, when you look through this report, I tried to focus not only on how the National Cemetery Administration would view the population numbers, but how we as a state would, how many veterans we would serve in those areas in a more realistic sense. And, you know, after going through this exercise and looking at these population numbers, you know, it appears that we have veteran populations in both southern corners of the state that have the potential of, you know, supporting a future grant for construction of future facilities. So, you know, I guess that I provide a little detail in here about, you know, my sources. There was a market potential done for the cemetery in Little Falls. I'm not a demographic expert, but I utilized the information that was available to me in my experience in Little Falls over the past 13 years in kind of understanding where our veteran burials are coming from in Little Falls. And, you know, I think the historic perspective of Little Falls tends to support the 50-mile ring. Therefore, you know, I consider the numbers on this report, especially the 50-mile ring, to be an accurate reflection of the potential veterans that would be served by these future facilities.
Before we go much further, I was part of getting the one in Little Falls. What size is it? I can't remember anymore.
The entire site is 37 acres.
My second question, you know where my heart is, I shouldn't say that, but I put the bill in to do it someplace in southern Minnesota. I didn't say whereabout it should be. What would you need for the same size, like 40 acres? Or I have no idea. What would be a decent size?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, 40 to 60 acres would be of, you know, suitable size to accommodate the number of burials that we'd be potentially looking at in the future. That's essentially what we have in Little Falls. As I said, 37, about 30 acres of the property in Little Falls is suitable for burial, and then, of course, you take out the area that's roads and facilities, and, you know, we net about probably 22 acres in Little Falls. You know, as a point of interest, I went back and kind of repeated this study in the same fashion for Little Falls, and, you know, the numbers kind of support what we're doing for an annual burial rate, which, incidentally, last fiscal year we provided burials for 335 veterans and their eligible family members, which I would guess that outside the metro area makes us one of the busiest cemeteries, whether church, city, whatever, in the state. So 40 to 60 acres.
Now my next question is going to be, how much more time or how many more years before Little Falls comes to the same reality as Fort Snelling, you run out of room?
Mr. Chairman, we've used less than 15% of our available burial sites in Little Falls, so we have a long future in Little Falls.
Now I'm going to talk about southwestern or southeastern Minnesota. You might have more burials there because you're not going to drive 4 or 5 hours where I live to Fort Snelling, I can tell you that. Some veterans would probably like to be there, but they don't want to get that far away from their home. That's just my own idea, and I might be wrong. But
Mr. Chairman, that idea is supported by, you know, demographic research through the National Cemetery Administration. It's really why they use the 75-mile ring, is that once you get further away from that, you know, which is an hour and a half drive for somebody, that families will typically choose a more local option, whether it be a city or church cemetery. And that was the idea of creating the 50-mile ring, was to show really more realistically the veteran population that would be served in those target areas.
I got two more questions, and I'm going to come over to Senator Scoy. We hear a lot about the Duluth Veterans Cemetery, and I've been hearing about, where is it at? According to this, they don't even really own the land yet, do they? Or am I not reading this right? They're negotiating?
Mr. Chairman, the proposed site in The Duluth area is actually part of Jay Cook State Park, so it is already a parcel of property that's owned by the state of Minnesota. There's enabling legislation that gives the commissioner's office between DNR and Veterans Affairs the ability to make an administrative change of ownership on that property.
If we were to build another cemetery or establish another cemetery in southeast or southwest, would we have to ask the legislature for some bonding to purchase this land, or just curious? I think I could find some. I think I could get some free land down there if I really went out and I'm not only my area but the other areas. I think there's some real willingness.
Mr. Chair, members, you know, if people want to donate land, that's great. If not, it would take some bonding money to purchase the land.
Okay.
But if people want to volunteer their land, it's always a nice option.
Now, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Puglisi, or the other witness. Your map is gone, but I couldn't help but notice the distinct lack of circles in the northwest part of the state. The only reason I mention it is I was part of a group in the Bemidji area that's doing a little work on vets issues, and they've done a survey of the vets in the area, and I think they had, I would say, 21 or 23,000 vets living within whatever the area was of Bemidji. Would that not be the size number that would you're talking about that would be suitable to service a cemetery? Am I kind of getting this right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scott, you're hitting it right. You know, the thing that we have to be mindful of is that that veteran population has to be within inside a certain radius, so a 75-mile radius. And in the northwest corner of the state, it's not as densely populated with veterans. We still could probably make a justification for having a state veteran cemetery there. It just probably would not fall as high on the priority list of the feds because it's not as densely populated by veterans, where the Duluth area and then down south is a little bit more densely populated.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Puglisi, is this a locally driven initiative, or where does the original impetus for these usually come from?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scott, this one was driven by the department. You know, we saw that there was a need for better coverage throughout the state for state veteran cemeteries. You know, the federal cemetery grants program is a great program. As I said earlier, they pay for the entire thing. So we felt that, you know, the timing was right to capitalize on the grants that they're offering. You know, DNR had a nice piece of land that we could get for free. You know, working with the VA, they identified that this is a target area for them that they'd like to see it. So everything really just fell into place, and that's how it came to be.
Thank you.
Senator Engelbrechtson, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the report. On your Exhibit A of the Duluth model, is that 25% of veterans carry through throughout the state? That's pretty much it?
Seek burial?
Yes.
To determine the...
That's pretty much a state average.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's supported by NCA research and demographics, that a 25% is a number that can be assumed to seek burial at this facility.
Thank you.
Mr. Scoggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Swantek, understand, I guess, the wish to be buried in a state cemetery. Is there state cemeteries across the border in Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota? Is there much sharing? Do the veterans from those states come into Minnesota to be buried?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, Wisconsin, Minnesota, we do not have a residency requirement for burial in our state cemetery. Wisconsin, however, does impose a residency restriction. It's one thing that kind of interested the National Cemetery Administration also in the Duluth area is the fact that we do not have a residency restriction. You have a fair population of veterans in the Superior Douglas County area of Wisconsin. Iowa just constructed their first state veteran cemetery that opened this past summer, located near Des Moines. So that's quite a ways south into Iowa. You know, looking at the south east site, you know, the ring would certainly extend out to even like La Crosse. You know, so as far as the federal government's concerned, they would also look at the population numbers that ring is touching into Wisconsin. I didn't want to focus my report on what we could potentially do for Wisconsin, rather on what we could do for our Minnesota veterans.
Mr. Chair, how about the Dakotas? Do they?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there is a state cemetery in Mandan, North Dakota. South Dakota does not currently have a state veteran cemetery. They have a national cemetery near Sturgis.
If we were to decide that we wanted another one in southwest, southeast, or other than Duluth one, is that just a pipe dream, or could we move that ahead? We have to have money from the federal government. Wouldn't it be even on the list?
Mr. Chairman, we can submit a pre-application for a grant to the National Cemetery Administration without having identified a specific site, without having authorized any funding for the project. Basically, that pre-application would identify a region, would identify the veteran population in that region, and it just establishes communication with the National Cemetery Administration that the state of Minnesota would have an interest in the future in looking at building a facility in that area. That could create the necessary buzz, if you will, to have potential donors of land come forward.
Any other questions, the members? Well, we'll revisit this issue. It's something very dear to me, and I want to see if we can move it further than the metro. It's a long ways from down where I live, 5-hour drive, and it's hard for the family who would like to come up for the burial, and maybe just wouldn't do it. But if it was closer, I think you'd have more of a family program. We'd mean more to the family if it was right there rather than drive 4 hours, 4.5, 5 hours up and that much back. So just something that
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
It sounds as though you're working up to donating a corner of your farm. Is that true?
I'll make that motion.
Senator Kubley, I might do that if I lived in Redwood, but I'm good. I'll have to talk to Senator Fredrickson and see if he can.
Jackson, not an option?
These are just target areas, so keep that in mind that, we certainly, it has to be there. It can be moved around, and, the populations get adjusted accordingly, but that's not to mean that is the one and only area. It just identifies a sweet spot.
Senator Vickerman, State Veterans Cemetery has a nice ring to it.
Any other questions? Yeah. I want to thank you for your good work. It really put a spotlight on some things that we've been thinking about here, where the circles would be and to pick up the number of veterans. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Next on the list is the County Veterans Service Working Group Report. Senator Hand, I believe you were part of this. Sort of being in fairness, I want you to get on and that end of the table.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. It's a crowded table, and I I think Senator Erickson Ropes, she was the co-chair of the committee, and I'm perfectly happy just to let her speak for the committee. She did a great job, and I think the committee did good work, but I appreciate the recognition. Thank you.
Well, you can talk from there, and I'll recognize
all right.
every second.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm happy to be here today to give you a report about the county veteran services officers working group that met during the interim. It was a result of legislation last year that directed a working group to come together and review the Office of Legislative Auditors recommendations that had to do with the CVSO program across the state. And as you flip through the packet in front of you, first I want to call your attention to all the colorful insignias on the front that we had a discussion about, actually. But I thought it was really important to show the stakeholders in this CVSO working group. It's really important whenever we're discussing any kind of changes to make sure that everyone who's going to be affected by a change should have a seat at the table to be able to have discussion and share input from their perspective. So for the record, it was the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Commander's Task Force, Minnesota Association of County Veterans Service Officers, members of the Senate, Senator Hahn and I, representative members from the House. It was Representative Al Junkie and Representative Smith. Members from MICA and AMC, as the county associations, were there as well. If you want to I'll just give you a little bit of an overview, and then perhaps Mr. Puglisi, can walk through in more detail, and we also have Mr. Bogart here to answer questions. But basically, the OLA recommended 11 recommendations for us to take a look at. We met over the interim many times and addressed 7 of them, and we have also addressed the remaining 4, but we need continuing conversations on those topics and recommendations. So we do have recommendations for this group on 7 topics, and ask your permission to just continue talking until our deadline date of next June. To continue on the last 4, which were are going to require a little bit more consensus building and conversation. But if you look on, where do we start here? On page 10, you'll see that we divided into 4 subgroups, 5 subgroups actually. One had to do with recommendations from the OLA on oversight. Second subgroup addressed recommendations on training and education. The third subgroup dealt with reporting requirements. The fourth subgroup dealt with enhancement grants. And then the last subgroup was talking about websites. So those were the general categories, and I will let the two gentlemen perhaps walk you through more detail of each of these recommendations.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, committee members, Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Chair, would you like us to get in depth with each one, or would you like just to give you a summation of how things are going? So I can talk for hours on this topic, there's no doubt. But, overall, there's a lot. It's some hard work that we're doing. We're not always on the same page, but we're very mindful that, we're meeting, and the outcome of this is to improve the service delivery model for CVSO so that, we can do a better job of assisting veterans. And everybody recognizes that. That's where we're heading. That's what we're trying to accomplish. But there are some differences, and some of these issues are pretty complicated. Reviewing the entire all the statutes that pertain to CVSOs, determining whether or not those are still viable, if there are changes that need to be made, that's going to take some time. So we didn't want to rush this process. So we did what we could do, the easier ones, the easier issues we addressed first, and we came up with some great resolution to those everybody was in agreement with. Some of the other ones are going to take, as Senator Rope said, a little bit more time, a little bit more discussion, a little bit more dialogue before we can get down to the nitty-gritty and make some recommendations. But overall, it's been a very good experience. Everybody's coming to the table with the right mindset. We've made some great progress, and I think we're going to really deliver a great product once we're done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps Mr. Golgart wants to share your perspective, too.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Golgart, the Vice President of the County Veteran Service Officers Association, also the Leesburg County Veteran Service Officer. As I will piggyback on what the deputy had said, is that everyone came to the table. No, we did not always agree, but we came to a consensus, and we do have some other issues that we need to continue to work on, some different things that are coming up. And I believe that everyone is willing to bend and work to make each area better for all of the veterans of Minnesota. I guess I'd like to kind of highlight on the training issue. That was one that is really taking off and really going forward. And that's something that the department and our association is working on as we speak, in regards to going towards the department-required certification and so many points and testing of that nature. And the department is now working with our association to kind of lean towards working with the National Association of County Veteran Service Officers in piggybacking on their training and their certification and accreditation, so that it will open up the doors for other accreditation with other national service organizations. The Department of Veterans Affairs is going to a five-year testing program, or a five-year requirement to re-accredit service officers within the particular organization. And the National Association has taken that stand in working with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and now we are bringing the National Association to the state of Minnesota in 2010. It's a big project that we've been working on, and the department has been very gracious to help us and to work with the association. In fact, we received a grant from the department to help train service officers in Minnesota next year in 2010.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to just add to that. You know, the training that we're looking at doing is the national training. They provide very detailed and specific training for CVSO, so it definitely is the right way to go. What we're going to hope to continue would be the CVSO enhancement grants, because we're using those grants. County Veteran Service Officers are using those grants for this training, so it's a wonderful way to get them this exceptional training. So I know there's a sunset date for those enhancement grants, so hopefully those can continue on, or we might have to rethink the future training of CVSOs.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to add that I'm really proud of all the stakeholder groups that were around the table. We did have some kind of prickly issues that we needed to deal with. Everyone was very respectful, and but when you're talking about oversight issues and who's going to be in charge and who's going to be in the oversight role and who's going to be performing functions, sometimes we have to, you know, move through those discussions very delicately. So I do want to say that one of the recommendations from the OLA was to clarify the department's oversight role concerning the CVSO program. And it was our group's discussion after we made very clear that it was not the department's intent to take over the county's functions or to use information to punish the CVSOs for any particular outcomes, that we're all in this for the best interest of the veterans and how best to serve them, that it was our recommendation that the transfer of power from the state to the state from the counties not happen, that the counties are doing a good job. I think our main concern is how we share information up the chain of command from the CVSOs and the jobs that they're doing, the good jobs that they're doing with veterans on the ground in the hometown, how we get that information into the system. So when we have conversations here at the Capitol about, well, what is a CVSO program, how many veterans are they serving, what are they doing, that we can have access to that information and facilitate that flow of information without jumping to conclusions about what just pure data means, because there's a big difference in the number of veterans served. If we just look at numbers on a page, it does not tell the entire story. There may be different veteran populations in different areas, and we want committees and people at the Capitol and the public to understand that whether numbers are up or down does not necessarily indicate lack of outreach or tremendous outreach going on at the county level could be that there are smaller veteran populations in particular areas and larger in others. It could be a lot of veterans out there perhaps don't have problems with mobility or housing or other federal benefits questions, so they're good, and then they in another area of the state may have a tremendous need from veterans. So as we go along and try to understand some of the reporting, which we're still going to continue to talk about, we also have to temper that with we can't just take a cookie-cutter approach to understanding veterans' needs on the ground.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, as Senator Rope said, you know, the report, the OLA report, it was a great report, you know, and it showed the great things that the CVSO Association is doing here in Minnesota, and it's very well known that this is probably the best, if not one of the best, county veteran service officer associations in the nation. So what the OLA report really did was it gave us some tools to look at how we can enhance what's already a good product. And we're taking it very seriously, and what we're really trying to develop are some really good best practices. You know, some of the offices across the state do a tremendous job. You know, there's always a couple of few problem childs here and there. What we're trying to do is create some great best practices that we can share across the county borders so that all of the counties can work together, use those best practices, use what's working in another county. But we have to be mindful, too. Counties are very different. You take a Hennepin County compared to a smaller county where they've got 90,000 veterans, different issues that they have compared to your county, for instance. Smaller county population, different needs. Not everything fits, so not one shoe fits everything. So we're trying to be mindful of that and not force certain things down everybody's throat. But as I said earlier, I think we're going to deliver a great product that's just going to enhance the service delivery model that we have.
And Mr. Chair, with that, on the data reporting, that's where, as the deputy had mentioned, the uniqueness of the comparing rural Minnesota to the metro area, that's where we're working with trying to determine what type of data is going to be useful so that it can be used to enhance the programs that we already have in place and or to bring new programs in to help the veterans. And that's one of the things that we are currently working on. I know I've been working with our president, President Lindsay, in developing a report so that we can present it to the group, and that's one of the issues that is in further discussion.
I want to be sure that they have the training and the knowledge to get all the federal funds. Everybody else is doing it, so I want our veterans officers to be able to get those funds. I don't know what they all are, but you would know what they are.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And as a member of the National Association, I am very involved with the National Association. I'm on the executive board and the treasurer, and I have been for the last 6 years involved with the executive board and was very instrumental in trying to bring them to Minnesota. And that's one of the issues that we are working on right now on the federal side is to bring more dollars out into the states, out into the counties, down to the county veteran service officers so that we can provide more outreach and get more benefits for our veterans. Because the more federal benefits that we bring into the individual counties, that's less state program or less state assistance that we need to provide to our veterans. So the more federal dollars we can bring is definitely better off for our veterans.
Mr. Chair and members, that's why we really want to go to this national training model. It's a great training that they provide. It's a week long. It's tailored for CVSOs. You know, and I'm proud that, you know, as a result of CVSO's efforts and the service organization's efforts, you know, over $1 billion in federal veteran money comes into the state each year. But it could be more. And with increased training and you know, and more outreach, we'll be able to grow that amount. And as Mr. Goldberg was saying, you know, the more federal dollars we get in, the less dependence we have to have on state dollars. So that's always our goal, is how do we maximize and bring in the most amount of federal dollars possible? And training is paramount. You know, the better trained they are, the better equipped they are, the better they're going to be at getting all these federal dollars and getting these claims through.
Mr. Chair, Minnesota is going to be particularly in a great position this year to get all our CVSOs up to the same point of training because Minnesota is hosting the National CVSO Conference here in June.
So, 2010.
Or 2010, I'm sorry. So everyone that's in the system will be on the same page by 2010.
And Mr. Chair and committee members, if you would look at Attachment 5, that kind of gives you an idea of the different type of training courses that are provided by the National Association, starting with the basic course, the accreditation course, which is a mandatory 32 hours where a service officer spends 32 hours training to learn everything involved with processing claims for our veterans. And then the continuing education training, they're required, our association requires that the service officers receive 16 units every year to maintain their accreditation. And if you look at the next page there, it shows the continuing education units and the association, the Minnesota Association and the department are working together this year to try and start the training model for our state association starting in this year with our spring conference in April and then follow up in our fall conference so that we follow the kind of the national guideline in the 16 units.
We're into a different time than we were when World War II. Now we've got National Guards. Minnesota seems to take more from Minnesota than any place. Another thousand's going to leave pretty quick, and the families are here. Families aren't there deployed 3-4 times, and they need more help because there's no way that we should have a veteran commit suicide. No way. So we got to figure out a way to get to those.
Mr. Chair, members, you're exactly right. And, you know, I would just like to point out that the county veteran service officers are an unfunded mandate. So it all falls upon the counties. So that's why I think the CVSO enhancement grant that was passed a few years ago really is a great way to support their efforts and to help them along. We also provide an operational grant to them. It's on a 3-year rotating cycle to help them upgrade their computer equipment and their office equipment. But anything the state can do to support their efforts, we should. We need to.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Hand, you have something you'd like to?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I also appreciate the efforts of the department and the stakeholder groups. And as Senator Erickson Rope said, this at times has been a very spirited conversation about some very real issues. And I learned a great deal from being a part of this committee. The county service officers have a big job. They do it very well. There's variety in how it gets done across the state in different counties. We have in statute a requirement for oversight, and I think that's one of the things that may be a part of what we're dealing with is that that statute calls for oversight, but it doesn't exactly say what that means. And so I think on the committee we wrestle with the recognition that, that we don't want to disrupt what is going on already that is going on pretty well, and at the same time we want to make clear what it is we expect from the department. And I think, as was pointed out, that's still an ongoing conversation, and we haven't gotten to the point where we can clarify that. I think that it may result in having some amendment to that statute if we can find a way to make that a little more clear. But I do want to just express my appreciation for the work of the county service veterans officers and for the department. And, again, I think Senator Erickson Ropes did a very nice job in chairing the committee and keeping us on track. And it was been an honor to participate in this, and we're going to keep working until we can complete our work. But thank you.
Any other questions? If not, I want to thank Senator Ropes, Senator Hahn for your good work. You know, we can't be everywhere in this place, so we would have to rely on people that can study the issues and bring it back to us. So I want to thank both of you personally for putting time into it. Thank all of you for coming, and then we'll move right into the next one, and that's report on women's veterans outreach and services. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, committee members, once again, Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. With me is Brandy Wilson, our Women Veterans Coordinator. I'm going to give you a little update on what her role is, some of the current things that are happening with women veterans, and possibly what we can do to maybe improve the situation for them.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Brandy Wilson. I am the Women Veterans Coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to provide you with an update on the Women Veterans Program. As you can see from my report, we have almost 23,000 women veterans in the state of Minnesota. Almost 9,200 of them are Gulf War veterans. That includes our OIF and OEF veterans. The program was created in July 1st, 2008 to identify and address the unique and specific issues for our women veterans. Women make up between 15 and 20% of the active duty forces today. Various studies conducted by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs have shown that anywhere from 55 to 90% of our women are sexually harassed while they serve in the active duty. Up to 20% of those women have reported to have been sexually assaulted or raped. And that, while that may sound like a very large number, it is actually a small number compared to what really happens. That's only 20% of reported women. Many women do not come forward and do not report when they have been assaulted or raped. As a women's coordinator, it's my responsibility to not only serve all of our veterans, but to focus primarily on our women to ensure that they are receiving the services that they need. My current caseload includes 32 active women veterans, and within the last 6 months, I have provided approximately 160 actions for our women veterans. Now, those actions include anything from taking a phone call to refer them to the agency that they need to go to or to other resources. It also includes working on their claims for them and also includes meeting with them, whether it's in the office or at another location where they're most comfortable, to try and point them in the right direction and best serve them. Additionally, it is my job to network with various agencies in the state to find out what services are available to women, not just for veterans, but for women, period, because women don't always want to go to a service that involves anything that has to do with the military. Often our women veterans, either one, don't identify themselves as veterans, or they look at the VA and the military as one and the same. So they look at the VA and they think of it as the same institution that damaged them, and they don't want to go there. They don't want to go and ask for help. They don't want to identify it. They don't want to report it. They don't want anything to do with it. So what I've been working to do in the outreach department is go out to various events and various organizations and work with them to network and find other resources that are available, such as rape counseling that is available for women that has nothing to do with the VA. In this state, we're very fortunate that the United States Department of Veterans Affairs has a medical clinic that is specific for women. They have a comprehensive women's clinic at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center, and that's good for our women because they have easy access to it. Also, the Vet Center has a women counselor she works specifically with women who have post-traumatic stress disorder due to military sexual trauma. Their outreach worker is also a woman, so she's able to reach out to women as well. Some of the things that I have done in the last 6 months is go out to events and go out to different organizations trying to reach out to women, but also educate different organizations on how they can help women veterans and what services are available to them. We've been trying to get a couple different things going. We go out to transition fairs out at the prisons to identify women who are there. We have gone on radio. I've been on a couple different radio shows throughout the metro area to talk about women issues as well as the programs that are available to assist them. Additional projects and stuff that we have going on that I am continually trying to identify areas where that we can improve in serving our women veterans. I have a women veterans conference that will be coming up in the fall. Date is yet to be determined, but we're hoping to bring in 500 women veterans, not just from Minnesota, but also to the region. So including Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, to invite them to also see what is available. This conference, we're trying to bring in speakers who could speak not just on women issues and not stuff specific to the VA, but just as a good way to bring women together. Maybe hopefully they can network with each other, and I realize that there are services that are available to them, and get some of the assistance that they need. We'll have service providers there. We'll have speakers for professional development, just self-improvement, such as financial planning, what woman couldn't use a little bit of assistance with financial planning or with resume writing. Just different speakers to come in, try to appeal to a crowd, a large crowd of women. Also have been working with the United States Department of Veterans Affairs on a program called Boot Camp to Veteran. It's a conference that they have provided annually that we have participated in, and it brings the different VA or veteran organizations together and invite all women to come in and meet with these people. They provide literature at their tables, and they're able to sit and talk to women throughout the evening so that they can gain additional information about what's available to them. Another thing that we are trying to do is we have a group that meets. We're trying to identify where we can improve women's services. How are we doing with our women veterans? We, you know, it's a newer program, so we're trying to gauge exactly where we're sitting with them and where we need to increase our services. And so we're in the process of developing a survey that was being provided at the reintegration events, but will also be provided at the events that I attend as well as my coworkers, and we'll have some in the office as well that women can anonymously fill it out and let us know, where does the state need to improve its services? Where can we help you more? Just continually trying to find ways to reach out to women, trying to get them to come forward. That seems to be the biggest struggle right now in the program. Many women, again, they're underserved because they're not coming forward. We're kind of in a catch-22 with our women where the services are available. They're there. You talk to most of the organizations, and they want to help women veterans, but we don't have women coming forward, so we're not quite sure what exactly they need. So we're going to try a couple different things. One of them is to reach out to women in a forum that is away from the military, away from the VA, even away from the office, looking at an outreach event like a coffee talk and bringing, you know, inviting women, any woman who has served in the military, to come, network, and maybe find out if they are eligible for services.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as Ms. Wilson is saying, you know, the biggest problem is getting the women veterans to come forward for assistance. So, you know, we're doing a lot of work to try to make them feel more comfortable to come forward. And that's why we created the Minnesota Service Corps recently, which is a community-based case management and counseling program. It has nothing, you know, we contracted with Lutheran Social Services. So it's nonprofit from the private sector. You know, there's a lot of veterans, not just female veterans, that don't want to go to the VA. They still see that close tie to the military. Had a bad experience in the military, they don't want to go to the VA. Now we're giving them options. We're empowering them with options so they can go and get some counseling from the community in which they reside. So this new program we created was one way to try and bring a comfort level to certain veterans that aren't comfortable with the current system. They have options now, and it's been quite successful. You know, really what we're trying to do is heighten awareness. A lot of our outreach is getting out there, making sure that the community, not just the veteran community, but the community at large, understands what's available so that if they encounter a veteran, they also can say, hey, did you know? Are you aware of? So a lot of what we need to do is continue to market all these different benefits and services that are out there. And that's a large part of what Brandy does.
Any questions? I'll have one last one.
What do you do with the families? I notice a lot of them have got children at home, and they leave, and maybe the children, maybe both parents, and somebody else has to raise the little ones for 6-9 months. Do you get involved much in that?
Mr. Chair, we do see that occasionally, and the best thing that I can do is refer them to some of the other agencies that serve active duty members, such as Minnesota Military Family Association or Assistance Centers, Minnesota Military Families Assistance Centers.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, you know, if they're still in the military, there's not a lot we can do because they're not yet veterans. But what we did do with the Minnesota Service Corps is we made sure that we don't just serve veterans, we serve family members as well and military members. So it's veterans, active military members, and their families we can serve through this new counseling service that's in their community at no cost to them. It's the first of its kind in the nation. I think it's going to be another nation-leading model that's going to spread across. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is looking to implement a very similar program like this. So that can help alleviate some of those concerns, because we all know the family suffers along with the veteran when they're called up. So we needed to do something to serve those family members as well. And the Minnesota Service Corps is going to do that.
Any other questions? The other day when Major General Shelto was here, he was telling about that females that took that airplane, and my staff looked it up on the Internet, and there was actually two. They flew two of those Black Hawks. Totally female pilots, gunner, everything. So if you get a chance, pull it up on it. It's quite impressive, I think.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we will. I mean, women play a much different role in the military today than they did years ago. They are in there, you know, and we see a lot of them coming home with very severe injuries, you know, not just mental health injuries, physical injuries. You know, they're in the thick of it. We need to take care of them.
Anybody else? Not. Thank you very much. We have one. Amy Ringingen. Why don't I just say Amy? I can't follow that up. So if she would come forward, and that is Director
thank
of
you, Senator,
Economic
Mr.
Status of Women.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee Member Wilson.
Amy, are you there? Okay. Well, maybe another day we can do that. So then that's all I have so far. Now we have two bills. The first bill we'll be taking up today is Senator Laurie stepped out.
Don't I get him, sir?
Yeah, why don't you, please?
Chair and members, Senate File 109.
Senator Laurie, I have to have your name for the record. I know who you are, but maybe the rest of them.
Senator Laurie, here to present Senate File 109. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ready? All right. As I think most of us are aware, back in the early 90s, the legislature created the Cooper SAMS Volunteer Ambulance Recruitment and Retention Program. There's been a lot of activity in this program over recent years, particularly as budgets have tightened up. There has been a balance built up in this fund. Last year, in order to balance our budget, $6.2 million was, over many of our objections, taken from this fund and used to balance our relatively meager deficit that we were facing at that time. Trying to read the tea leaves and see where we're at right now, we felt that the remaining balance in this budget is really in danger of being utilized to balance our general fund deficit. And so in an effort to utilize some of these funds to their best purpose and in concert with the original intention of these funds, recruitment and retention, we thought, and when we started looking at this, there was a balance of over $10 million in the fund, and we thought we should probably take maybe 15% of it and invest it today in recruitment and retention initiatives, only one of which brought us before this committee today, and then get ready to take our licks at the end of the day when push comes to shove and we're looking for any fund with a balance to, you know, just realistically get out of this session intact. So I will go quickly through some of the projects that we were looking at and a couple of other things that happened last year, too, that made this able to be done is what this fund is utilized for is basically a small retirement package for volunteer ambulance crews that are that have been really hard to recruit and retain, particularly through Greater Minnesota, an issue that I've been here before working on and plan to be here for a long time working on making this situation better. Last year, we did put in the statute, we fixed the amount that would need to come at $447 per credit year of service. And we also backed that with a $700,000 general fund appropriation that should be sufficient to pay out that per credit year amount going forward, which we believe truly does put the rest of the balance of the fund at even greater risk because it's kind of hard to justify the need for that large balance going forward. So, again, we had initially thought that 15% of something over $9 million was a reasonable amount to invest in recruitment and retention efforts today. Of course, we're all painfully aware of the downturn we've experienced. The balance in the fund is today something much closer to $5 million. With that in mind, we do have an author's amendment, an A1 amendment, that I'd like to pass out and adopt before we finish here today. And that basically brings the investments out of this fund from about $1.5 million to just shy of $1 million in the investments. And with that, maybe I'll just start, and as soon as everybody has the A1 amendment, we can act on that. But some of the things, a first responder reimbursement project that I'm actually pretty excited about. I think that could actually show some really valuable methods of helping our rural ambulance folks survive by providing them some method of compensation. Right now, they cannot get compensated from any of our health plans for the work that they do, and it can also be a very beneficial service for, you know, saving healthcare costs overall. They could certainly provide this service at a much lower rate for those patients who don't need that higher level of an actual hospital ambulance coming out. Regional EMS programs would get some of these investments. Comprehensive advanced life support would get some. An emergency medical services for children program would get some also. And then the investment that brings us before this committee is another very critical one, I believe, one that actually we did try very hard to fund last year. We had $100,000 for the Veterans Paramedic Apprenticeship Program in our budget right until the very last hours of session, and it was removed, and I know many of us were pretty upset about that. But right now we have about 800 combat medics returning from the Middle East is the current projection, and these are highly skilled medical professionals that have really invaluable experience and are ready to step up to the plate and help us with some of this. But unfortunately, the military training doesn't transfer to civilian ambulance services. So we've got people with the skills ready to move, and they need a little bit of a kickstart in terms of making their training move over. So it would provide employment while the veterans are continuing education for their civilian ambulance duty. And that one we actually did not reduce in the author's amendment that brings it back. We're proposing $200,000 be spent for this Veterans Paramedic Apprenticeship Program to get them a jump start. So with that, say a few words or just stand for questions? With that, we'd stand for questions. Does everybody have the A1 amendment? I actually didn't. No, I brought my copy. That's an author's amendment, so I would like to move that.
Our lawyer moves the adoption of the A1 amendment to get the bill in order. He'd like to have it. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill's in order.
Okay. I guess we'd like to make a couple of additional comments.
Mr. Chairman, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. As many of you, or at least some of you may know, also in another life, I was a nationally registered paramedic. When I first started out, my partner was a combat medic who'd gotten his training and experience in Vietnam. About the fourth call I was on involved a school bus and two vehicles in one of the most terrible accidents you could imagine. And we even had we had firefighters there, we had police officers there, and you can imagine there was a lot of chaos, there were a lot of upset people, and it was a pretty emotionally draining ambulance call, to say the least. Well, Mike Hall, who was this combat medic, absolutely did the most extraordinary job of triaging people, calming people down, knowing who needed to be getting what kind of care, where, and he had the most extraordinary effect on everybody, and it was largely as a result of his experience in dealing with some of the horrendous trauma that he had dealt with in Vietnam. We have individuals just like Mike coming back who are an extraordinary resource, and they're interested in pursuing careers in civilian emergency medical services, and to lose these people is just unforgivable. And again, as their author said, did an excellent job. We need some dollars to get this program formalized. We've been doing it on a volunteer basis right now with individual ambulance services working, giving the medics a job while they're going to additional training, and we believe that these dollars will help to that end. I won't go into it today, but this is part of a larger program that we hope to pursue that would involve tax credits for employers, property tax credits for people who are willing to relocate to underserved areas for ambulance. But in this economic climate, I'm afraid to even mention them any further than that today, but we will be pursuing that in the future. Very much appreciate your support.
Chair Lurie.
Mr. Chair, yeah, thank you. I should make a couple of additional comments in the presentation of this bill, because it is actually with a bit of a heavy heart that I bring this bill, because, you know, wiping out this fund, you know, starting to use this fund in anticipation of its being wiped out is a very, very painful thing that I do. And I do know that it is not universally loved, this idea. We've been working on what we think is the most realistic picture of how to move forward and utilize these funds towards the goals that were set up, the recruitment and retention goals. I do understand that the EMSRB does have some concerns. I don't know if anybody from that entity is here today to testify or anything, but I do want to recognize that this is not an easy thing to be bringing forward. It is not a win-win-win situation. It is something that we bring forward reluctantly, but with a bit of reality in terms of the dire situations that we're facing right now, and it is trying to make the best of a very, very difficult situation.
Senator Coobley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for your comments, Senator Lurie. I appreciate your recognition of that. My question is for you, Mr. Doyle. I mean, did the EMSRB at their last meeting back off of their opposition to the use of this fund?
Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coobley, I met with the executive director earlier this week, and we had a discussion. From what I understood, they are not going to formally oppose this legislation. They did have some concerns about what the proposal is on shifting the money around, and that's the way I understood it. I think that the redeeming fact is the legislature, some foresight last year, by locking in an annual service credit of $447 a year, which is the highest annual credit that there has ever been, plus an appropriation of $700,000 a year in the base funding, has maintained this program and made it more secure than it has ever been in the past. And with those changes, this fund, the $5 million, is now totally separated from the program itself and is just sitting there. So there is no direct relationship between the $5 million we're talking about now and the Cooper Sams Fund because of the $700,000 annual appropriation and the $447 credit.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Coakley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Doyle, so you're telling me that you were not at the meeting, that the source of your information then comes from the director. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Senator Coakley. And as I said, I'm cautious in those remarks. I did understood it that they, I don't think they're crazy about it, but I don't think that they are going to formally oppose this.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Doyle, you know, I guess I've been a member of that board for the past 6 years. The board did take a formal stance against using this particular longevity fund, primarily because, as Mr. Laurie mentioned, it does help in both, you know, recruiting members for volunteer ambulance associations and for their retention. You know, I guess, you know, I don't think the director would say that they haven't taken a formal stance against it unless the board acted to repeal or rescind their prior action. So, you know, I don't, you know, I spoke with the director just a couple days ago, too, and she told me that she had told you and Mr. McAlpin that the board was officially opposed to using this money for this purpose. I don't think they need it all, and frankly, maybe they can part with this portion of it. But, you know, I guess my concern is that we've got people out there now that are worried that their retirement benefit will no longer be there. And if we have a surge of retirements for the next year or two, will the $700,000 be sufficient? I'm aware that they have not used that amount in the past, but if we have, you know, even twice as many retirements, we'll be a couple hundred thousand short. I guess I'd like to see a portion of that longevity award fund retained for that purpose in the event that we have that kind of a problem and we have, you know, half of our volunteer ambulance people who don't get that anticipated award at the end of their service.
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coakley, let me be clear. I certainly cannot speak for the EMS Regulatory Board or the chair. The comments they had about them not taking a position on it is what I understood, and I would certainly not want to challenge the integrity of anybody in the process. So if I misrepresented that, I apologize. That's the way I understood it. The most that we have ever spent and reimbursing those who are quote-unquote retiring, I believe, has been between $350,000 and $400,000 a year, thus leaving a remainder of roughly $350,000 in the fund that is unspent. Now, this issue about having more people applying for their payout then there was money available was anticipated when we put this bill together. There was a specific number that said, I believe, the first 436 applicants would be paid out. After that, they would go into a line where they would queue up the following year, then they would be paid out when the money was available again. So this was anticipated when we drafted the legislation. It's also pretty clear in the law where it says that this trust account at all times is subject to a levy under the execution of any general creditor of the state of Minnesota. It was made clear when it was drafted that this money is not a pension and is not. It also says it is a gratuity established by the state of Minnesota and may be modified by subsequent legislation at any time without allowing any cause of action by any ambulance service personnel. So we went into this when we drafted the legislation many years ago. It may disappear. We may have pieces of it taken out as it's been taken in the past. We felt that what happened last year with the legislature locked in our annual credit amount at 447 and the base funding every year, that we were going to be as safe as we will ever be, and perhaps safer than we had ever been in the past. Now, if there are more requests for payouts this year, they will simply have to wait 1 year. They'll be put at the top of the list in the order in which they applied, and then they will receive their payout.
Mr. Chair, got a follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I think this is a good bill, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to kill it, but I would like to see the EMSRB, the regulatory board, offer some support for it, and I think we could do that, but I'm just not sure that that we ought to move ahead with it right this minute. I did talk to Director Burke Moore, the same as Mr. Doyle did. I guess, you know, our understandings are different, and frankly, that's my understanding. I'm expressing my understanding to Mr. Doyle. I don't mean to call your integrity into question. I've known you for quite a while, and I appreciate what you do. But, I would be much more comfortable with this if we had what I felt was a clear signal from the regulatory board that they were either neutral or that they were in favor of supporting it. I guess having been a medic in the military myself, I think there is a lot of unused potential there for this kind of thing, and I'd like to see it move forward. But I wonder if it might be best to wait a little bit on that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Laurie and members of the committee, look on the bill. What we should be talking about is Subdivision 4, Veterans Paramedic Apprenticeship Program. We really shouldn't get into the rest of it. That doesn't come before this committee. If this passes, it'll go to finance. They've already asked for it. So
that's what I was going
to. I'd like you to concentrate on Subdivision 4.
And if I could, too. Concentrate on Subdivision 4, but still make one broader comment briefly, is that, you know, we're using about 20% of the fund. And so to the extent that the argument is we need to leave something in the fund, we have left about 80% in the fund that we can still argue. And the arguments about how much needs to be left are still valid. And whatever needs to be left is there. I mean, make no mistake, this fund is a sitting duck right now. And I will personally reach out to Mrs. Burkmore, the new executive director, and work on it. And we'll, you know, with your assistance, I do hope that we move from this committee. And I'll get on to finance, and I will work very hard with the EMSRB and see if I can't clarify the various statements of intent. But I would like very much to move.
Senator Coyne.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to weigh in and just say that I do support this. I actually think it's very good policy. And Senator Laurie hit the nail right on the head when he said that this fund is a sitting duck. Senator Laurie and I serve in the Health and Human Services Budget Division. We're going through things page by page, and believe me, if there is any dollars anywhere, they're going to be gathered in. And so I think it's important that we can, if we can do something like this, this is good policy. The money is actually there. I think we need to pass this the more quickly or the better before somebody gets their fingers in that cookie jar, in my opinion. So
Any other questions? Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Coring that it is a good bill, and I think I would also further agree that I think, you know, most of that money would be used in some capacity, and I'd like to see this bill pass. I'm just not comfortable, having been a member of that board for a number of years, that the board has not explicitly stated you know, support for using the Longevity Award. And I know it's not about the money, but the Longevity Award is listed in this bill as being the source. And so it seems to me that, you know, I would not be comfortable voting in favor of it at this point, even though I would like to support it in the long run.
Any other questions? Senator Hamm.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Lurie, I just want to make sure I understand, and I guess I just want to talk about Subdivision 4, and we'll leave the larger issues to some other committee at this point. But the and again, I'm understanding this is appropriating money from a fund that already exists, so it's not a new appropriation, and it's $200,000, and notwithstanding the argument that this might be taken up and done something else with, I just want to understand what the $200,000 is used for. What is actually done with that money? I've read some of the material here, and it's used to support apprenticeship, people coming from the military who are in training, but is this to pay for their training, or what's the mechanism here that we're funding?
Sure. I mean, we actually do have the coordinator of how it would be used. I mean, there's going to it takes some funds to help transition these combat medics into and have their skills made available to our civilian ambulance service. And we can. I'm sorry, your name again. Lance Ross is the one who would be kind of in charge of these. He'd be able to give much better specifics than I.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Lance Ross. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Ambulance Association and very excited about this program. The dollars go to coordinate the returning vets working with Deed, Dolly. Just met with another gal here today that we can start coordinating some of the training dollars that the veterans can get and their GI Bill dollars and work with them. Been working with MinSCU folks on trying to get credit for their service and some of the classes that they have, like their Combat Lifesaver group, and it's really coordinating all that. I'm the point person, so when a workforce center has a vet that comes through, they can call me, and I start looking to place them with an ambulance service, get them on with a education program. Some of them are coming back with a combat medic, which a medic, what we have in an ambulance right now that you hear going by the Capitol, and a combat medic, they have some of the same skills, but not all the same skills. They're very versed in trauma, but maybe not OB and some of the medical pieces. So it's helping bridge that gap and coordinate with them and working with all the different branches of the military in order to do that. It's really helping connect the dots. And the apprenticeship program, I place them with a service, and they start, it's a 2,000-hour apprenticeship program through Dolly, and they start working on their, maybe it's an EMT or all the way up to paramedic.
Senator Hamm.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ross. So the $200,000 is what, paying your salary then? Is that, I mean,
it's
I'm
paying for the coordination, yes.
Okay, so, and Mr. Chairman, that's what I'm trying to understand. This is not funding the training for the people coming back from the service or paying their salary as they are working. It is paying for the activity to direct them to this program or that program. It's paying an organization or, I don't know if it's more than just you personally, but an organization to say, okay, here's a program, you can go there, and whatever that work implies, phoning or computer searches, but staff work, is that essentially what the money is doing?
Yes. I can elaborate on that if you'd like, Mr. Chair or Senator.
Sure.
It's getting them involved and connecting them so they can start working and getting them with an ambulance service. We're a trade association, and this is connecting the dots for them to get them in the hopper, so to speak, and connected with possible employers and having them start as an apprenticeship where they can get paid so they have dollars coming in while they're going to get their paramedic license. Many of them have their EMT basic, but they want to move on to get their paramedic. That's schooling, which it costs, They can use their GI Bill, things like that. But it's also putting, you know, they can use the dollars to pay for other bills, pay for food, things like that, their housing. Some of them might need to relocate to a spot where paramedic school is. So it's really helping get their foot in the door for something they're very passionate about. They want to go back and work with their community or work with a community and continue on with their medical experience and also broaden that medical experience. Yes, it's staff time for me, but it was volunteer time before for an association that's running ambulance services on a daily basis. So,
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ross, now I'm confused. Is the money being paid then to veterans to help them pay their food bills and housing bills and training costs, or is the money going to a organization to just facilitate the identification of opportunity?
The money is helping them start working in the field. The money is paying for the trade association to coordinate and get these medics as they're coming home, as they're going to the workforce centers. It's, again, connecting the dots. We're not paying for them to their food, but it's helping them get with an ambulance service, which is getting them a job, which is also getting them the ability to be in the apprenticeship program so they can go to school and get their paramedic. So it's opportunity, I guess.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ross, if this didn't exist, would they not be able to find these positions then?
I would say it'd be tougher. I get a lot of phone calls on how to connect the dots and things like that with the ambulance services. In order to have an apprenticeship program, you need to have a trade association assist with that.
Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I can shed a little light on my 35 years of law enforcement public safety experience. Over the last 15 years, volunteers were really hard to come by. I mean, it's just getting to be that way through the fire service and all the volunteer EMS service, and I look at this as a wonderful opportunity to utilize that kind of expertise coming home, hitting the ground and probably been away from something for a long time, not fully employed, and to be able to utilize them and get them in there and get them trained, and I think it's a great thing. You and I, we talked about it before, I know, over the times, and so I think it's a great thing.
Any other discussion? Senator Lurie, what do you want to do with your bill? It has to go to finance.
I move that it be recommended to pass and referred to finance.
As Senate File 109 as amended, you reckon?
As amended.
To pass when bill re-referred to finance. Any further discussion on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Now, Senate File 288, Eric and Ropes, Veterans Homeless Prevention Program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm here today to advocate for additional spending. I'll just put that right out there. There's a really great program going here, and we're going to be talking about it, that Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans manages, and they usually get grant money, $750,000 grant money, each year is added to the base to the MACV to support veterans. Due to the economic crisis, the department supports this work, but will not be requesting funding due to the deficit. And my understanding is that the department has told them if they want some funding, they can come and ask for it, but it's not going to be part of the department's budget. So I do believe that there's a real compelling economic and moral argument for continuing this outreach to some of our neediest veterans. I bring a bipartisan bill today that would continue that work I want to emphasize that the work that MACVI does is non-duplicated work. So this is a safety net between services that are not provided by other veterans organizations or programs in the state. And I just want to tell you just a little bit about MACVI. They've probably been before this committee before, but to refresh your memory, they're a nonprofit organization that has been serving veterans and their families that are in crisis throughout Minnesota for the last 16 years. And typically they are funded, as I said, through grants to the general fund and then through the department. They provide non-duplicated services. Again, I just want to really emphasize that. And in 2009, they're estimating 4,000 veterans will be experiencing either an episode of homelessness or other life crises that typically MACVI deals with. And we're going to hear some testimony a little bit about the numbers of veterans that are served in Minnesota. It's just a critical year. As we all know, we're dealing with budget issues, but so are the veterans, and so are the veterans' families. And when they have nowhere else to go, they go to the department, they go to the service organizations, they go to nonprofits that deal with veterans for assistance. And this is one of those really critical areas here. When we're talking about vets on the street or vets losing their homes or vets in family crises, Mr. Chair, you mentioned earlier, you know, we don't want to have a state where any veteran has to consider suicide as a solution. We need programs like this, and I'd just like to introduce Kathleen Vitalis, who's the executive director for MACVI. She'll tell you a little bit more about the organization and the numbers of people that this organization is serving.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Yes, I'm Kathleen Vitalis with Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, and I'd first like to thank Senator Erickson Ropes sincerely for her carrying this bill for us. I'm a big proponent of the bottom line, and she already got to the bottom line. This is new money, but it is not a new program. And our outcomes, and I've given you all a package of information that you can look through, but our outcomes from 2007 to 2008, we had a 58% increase in the veterans that we serve statewide. And that was 870 veterans and their families, representing approximately 8% female veterans, with that number rising. Veterans with families, over 30%. Veterans with a disability, 76% of who we served. And the OIF-OEF veterans, 17% and rising as the war continues. I do want to acknowledge the people in this room that are here to support us today, including my staff, and most importantly, the veterans that we have assisted, some currently and some in the past. And you'll be hearing from three of those veterans, and I will keep my comments brief so that you can hear from them directly. This bill affects everybody at this table, because we did do our homework. I went through and we assisted veterans in every county of all of the senators that are sitting here today. And I think that's important, because it does show that we truly are statewide. I think that at a time when we need it most, not getting this funding would represent a 75% reduction in the services for the veterans that we serve right now. We also provide housing for disabled veterans and transitional housing for homeless veterans. We've got our own housing projects in Mankato, in the Twin Cities, and a new rehab project in Duluth. I wanted to point that out. That leverages another key with a nonprofit, is that you leverage other funding. We're asking the state to partner with us, but not be the sole source of our funding in any way. We leverage federal funding, and one grant that I want to point out, because it has outcomes that are supported by housing stabilization with the money we're talking about here, But the Department of Labor gives us an employment grant in the metro area. Last year, 148 homeless veterans, they went from homelessness to stabilization to employment, representing annual gross wages of $3.5 million. That's one program that we have that is supported in part by some of this funding. And we have many other programs like that. The key is we fill gaps in services, but more importantly, we advocate for these veterans and coordinate services and sources of funds on their behalf. When you're a person in crisis, you can't go to seven different sources, seven different addresses, seven different agencies and fill out 500 different forms. You need someone to walk with you and to help you with that. And that's what we do. So we use some of our own funding, but at the same time, we leverage all of the sources of funding that are out there. And we stress that we don't duplicate other services, that we partner and collaborate. Every fund out there has eligibility criteria. And for example, energy assistance. You can apply for it, but it sometimes takes 4 to 6 weeks to get it. What do you do in the meantime when your fuel oil tank is empty? MACV is there. And we go in and work with those programs. We partner very closely with the county veteran service officers throughout the state. We ensure that these veterans are being, that their benefits that they could get are being applied for, both federal and state. As you know, no one organization can tackle these complicated issues alone. And I can't stress enough how we partner with others to achieve this, including absolutely the Department of Veterans Affairs. They view us very positively. They support us. We couldn't do this without them. And we are their homeless or at crisis veteran program. We outreach. We educate. Most people, as you know, don't even ask if someone's a veteran. Because if you ask that question, you very likely could get an answer that could increase that person's income and stabilize them. We leverage funding from many corporations and foundations, again, other partners, Veterans for Veterans Foundation, the Minneapolis Foundation. We do go after funds across the board. And individual donors, as a 501c3, the other thing we do is we involve the communities in this issue. And we get donations from donors. And one that I have to mention that came in today that will give you an example of our outreach and our support, Trinity Lutheran Church, Wendell, Minnesota. They heard me speak at Fergus Falls Veterans Home 2 months ago. They went back to their church, and they challenged their membership to raise some funds for us. They sent me a check for $635. Now, that may not sound a lot to you, but Wendell, Minnesota has a population of 177. We do outreach. We do connect. We advocate for the veteran, piecing this puzzle together, walking beside them as they do that, but we need the state to continue to walk with us. We need this funding to go forward, especially when our numbers are increasing. And to this end, I would like to have you hear from three of our veterans briefly, because it is the faces behind the funding. You've got the bills and the policies and the paperwork, but what about the people that it affects? And Senator Vickerman, committee, I absolutely agree. We cannot ever have a veteran have suicide as the only answer that they face, but we cannot have homeless veterans in the state of Minnesota. And so now I'd like to introduce Kurt Nordland, and we have two others that'll give some brief comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Kurt Nordland. Grateful recovering alcoholic and addict. In September of 2004, I came to the VA hospital, failed suicide. I was homeless. I had a bad alcohol and drug problem. I had went to Building 47, which is, you know, the house for homeless vets, and they had immediately put me in the VA hospital where I had went into the Locke psychiatric ward for 3 weeks. Well, upon completing that, I had went from there to Building 10 across from the VA hospital and went through the partial psychiatric hospital program, you know. And from there I had went, because I was a homeless veteran, went to Building 47. Now, when I went to Building 47, I had nothing. I was a homeless man. I had a drug and alcohol problem. I barely had a month and a half sobriety. When I went to Building 47, that's a 12-step AA-NA program. They not only gave me a place to live, they gave me the proper nutrition I needed to live. They gave me hope. There's 5 things I think about today when I think about MACV, besides the fact that they saved my life, literally. The 5 things that I think when I think about MACV is think about honor, respect, commitment, trust, and compassion. All of those things they had and they had gave me when I was there, when nobody in the world gave me anything. Currently, right now, I had just celebrated on the 3rd of February almost, well, actually 51 months of sobriety, being clean and sober. I'm currently a federal employee at the VA hospital, and I have been for 3 years this past November 15th. I can honestly tell you that me being here today without MACV, I would be dead. And, you know, I pay taxes. I matter in the world. You know, it's everything. So, you know, to me, MACV, they're everything. And there's a lot of people that are like me right now that are out there in the community. And I hate to think that if MACV isn't around no more, what will happen to them? Because none of us as veterans, none of us as fathers, as people in the community, we shouldn't have to be homeless. We live in the richest nation in the world. We live in the great state of Minnesota. When MACV had asked me to come here today, I thought about a lot of things I could say and this and that and everything. But the mere fact that I have a chance to come in here and speak to this great committee, you know, it's everything. So, you know, hopefully that this will make a difference. And I thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Okay. Senator Ropes, you have another?
Yes, sir. Thank you. We also have Leroy Naaman.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name's Leroy Naaman. Actually, it's William. I get called by my middle name, Leroy. I think it's my dad's joke. But I'm here to testify for MACV because I came to MACV in about 98, 99. At the time, before then, I was homeless. I was an alcoholic. I was living basically in Minnehaha Park in middle, you know, summer at the time. We're in winter, living in cars, garages.
It's a tricky chair, boy.
The night before Bill ran into me, Bill Johnson, that's right, of VA, I was contemplating to jump in off the Ford Bridge. Cause I was wet, tired, just couldn't go any further. Well, one day he came through where I was staying at, and I just happened to be at Kristen Catholic Charities down off of Chicago there, just getting something to eat. And he came up to me and asked me if I was a veteran. Sort of like, yeah, I'm a veteran. You know, why you're asking? He asked me if I like to have 3 meals on a cot. And so I sat there, thought about it, and had my pint of vodka in my back pocket, you know, sitting there. I said, I guess not. Why not? And, you know, because the whole time I was thinking about that. They sent me up to St. Cloud and stuff, and I wasn't sure and everything. But when they gave me that chance, that day they gave me that chance, it sort of changed my whole life. When I got to McVee, I realized I had a second chance. They gave me a second chance. They re-taught me how to start respecting myself, how to live again, how to start dreaming. I always wanted to be an engineer. I wasn't very, I wasn't college educated. I was sort of poor. But they made me realize that I could dream again. Hope. And I started working with them, and they were, you know, they taught me how to how to wash clothes again, how to, you know, just do basic life, everyday life things that most people take for granted. Because I had, you know, living out in the streets, living in parks and trash cans and eating out of trash cans, you know, you just sort of forget all your basic needs. But, you know, with their home and their education and with their 12 steps and career force, because, you know, Jimmy Lee over there realized I had a chance and I was going to go for it. I happened to be a supervisor, WG 10 at the VA hospital, engineer, pipe fitter for the VA Medical Center in Minneapolis. I didn't ever thought I would be an engineer, but I am. And if it wasn't for MacVee, I wouldn't be here today either. I'd be dead somewhere. They'd be finding my body somewhere. I can't thank these guys enough to, you know, bring back my pride, you could say, my dignity, finding out, actually being used to who I am, finding out who I am, what I can actually contribute, which they did, which I do every day. I can't seem to do enough. When I run into a homeless veteran, I tell them, you know, they tell me their problems and stuff, and I send them over to you guys and see what you can do for them. And I'm just overwhelmed. I'm sort of lacking words because it's indescribable, the feeling when you're from homeless and eating out of trash cans to where you are working. I'm a supervisor. I just got married a year and a couple of days ago, plus I bought a brand new house out in Eagan. So from zero to this and feeling normal again, I can't thank these guys enough. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Senator Ropes, do you have another person?
One more. Jessica Daniels, and she's a female veteran that came down from Duluth today.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Former Army Sergeant Mortuary Affairs, Jessica Daniels. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon and thank you for speaking with me today. In 2005, my husband was medically boarded from the Army. He was given his severance pay only to pay it back all to the VA for his disability check. We only received $400 a month until his disability, or until his severance pay was all paid back. In 2006, I was informed by my commander that my family care plan was unacceptable due to my husband's severe PTSD. I was involuntarily family care planned out of the Army. Due to this, I was made to pay back $8,000 for my unused portion of a bonus that I had received.
They took my final paycheck from me, and they left me and my family stranded, penniless, and homeless in Colorado. At the time, we had four children and stayed wherever we could. We were stuck there for almost 2 months. When we were finally able to come home, we stayed between several family members. Household families just jumped from family to family members because my family was so large. My husband and I found jobs and moved into our home. It was a very small rental house in a very, very bad neighborhood. Soon after moving in, my husband lost his job, being told that the employees there did not like him. They said he had always held his head too high and seemed too sure of himself. We were barely making it when we found McVie, and because of McVie, they helped us keep our house we were renting. Eventually, because of McVie, we have been able to rent a home big enough for all five of my children now. They each have their own bedroom. They paid the deposit for us. I kept working, and my husband started going to school full time to pursue an engineering degree. Things were finally looking up, and then I lost my job. What happened to my husband happened to me. It is very clear to me that people like us, soldiers, do not fit into the civilian world. Again, McVie rescued us, putting groceries in our house, paying our heat and utilities, so we could get back on our feet. I am still jobless, still looking for work, and whenever we start to drown, McVie throws us a lifeline and saves my family from being homeless. They do not give handouts, but they give a hand up. They steady you when things are wobbly. They work with you to help you straighten out your finances. They keep veterans like me and others off the streets. And they give us hope in seemingly hopeless situations. I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I put this very important bill before you. I don't think there's much else to say. Again, I would just repeat what Kathleen reminded you of. We've heard testimony today from veterans across the state. And McVie has helped veterans in every one of your counties. So I would ask you to look favorably upon this bill. It's a spending bill. It's not included in the department's budget. But I think, again, there are compelling moral reasons to pass this bill on to finance.
Senator Coring.
Mr. Chairman, just kind of to clarify, how does this work now? We're actually today, we're really deciding if this is good policy, correct, Mr. Chairman? And I see you shaking your head, yes. So then it goes to the Finance Committee. Then what does it eventually come back? Would this be under our division or?
Senator Coring, if this bill passes, it's my wish and my hope that we put it into an omnibus budget bill that we're going to be looking at.
So it would be under your, Mr. Chairman, it will be under your division then. Okay. Okay.
Senator Hamm?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What spending targets does this committee have this year?
We don't have what we're working on. This is just the second bill I believe we put through the committee. And it'll come. But I want to tell you, I've been thinking, my old head here is starting to wake up. I picked a paper up today, early this morning, 6 o'clock. Opened it up. And the people that we bailed out of that stimulus package went on all kinds of junkets, expensive junkets. So it's my pleasure that I'm going to work with Representative Alan Junkie, and we're going to ask for a share of that stimulus package. It creates jobs, so why shouldn't we? We're not asking for much. $1.5 million, they spent more than that. They dropped more than that. But that's because we're in a tough situation. So why shouldn't we at least try that and see what they do? That's what I'd want the blessing of the rest of you, but I think it's we should at least try.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I'm not in objection to that at all, and I think that if there is some financing that the state can take advantage of, that then we got to look at that. The concern I have is, and I support completely what the MACV does, but I find it very difficult to say that we are going to spend money that we don't know if we have, that we do have a proposal from a budget that the governor's put out there and it has the department recommendations and this isn't in it. And I know that we're not obligated to take the governor's budget. I understand that. And I don't think that we will in its entirety. But I think that it is difficult to send the message that we're going to do something when we don't have any idea of how we're going to put this together or what we have to trade off to do this. If we are going to have so much money, then we're going to have to make choices about what we fund and what we don't. And I don't know all the things that are on the table. And so I'm just questioning, Mr. Chairman, the timing of this and whether we ought to be doing this until we know more clearly exactly what the total picture that we're looking at. That's my concern. I support this bill. I support this effort. I'm just very troubled by doing this at a time when we don't know what the framework that we're working with is.
On the other hand, I'm going to ask Mr. Michaels to help me through some of this.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, what we're going to do here today would be similar to the process that we followed last budget cycle, is that the recommendation would be that this bill be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus budget bill, and that at a later date when we're given our budget target, we would see how this would fit in with the other projects that this committee's recommended and then make a determination on whether it's included and at what funding level.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Michaels, thank you. I understood that this was going to be passed on to another committee, and if that's the case, then I think that's not appropriate. I think it's fine to take this and put it on the table and say we'll think about doing this as long as we're clear and people listening are clear that, at least from my position, from what I'm hearing, we can't commit to absolutely doing this until we see what we have to work with and all the other demands that we're going to be faced with. And as long as that is clear and as long as we're saying we'll just recognize the importance of this and let's put it out here and make sure we consider that when we put the bill together, I'm fine with that.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well. I'm asking for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Senator, do you move that the Senate file 288 be recommended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill? It doesn't say we're going to do it. It says for possibly it could be in there. So we see how much money we have when we get to that point. Everybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Adopted members, thank you very much for your patience, and this meeting is adjourned.